So, George, these are power looms that were built in the 1870s, 1880s, a bit later.
That's right, yeah.
But they wouldn't have changed very much over the period from about 1840, 1850 onwards.
I mean, modern weaving now is exactly the same principle, but of course now, on majority of my cloth, they don't use shuttles anymore.
Right.
It's either air jets, water jets, or rapiers.
I mean, I think what's interesting about, one of the many things that's interesting about machines like this is when they were introduced in the middle of the 19th century, these were really the symbols of industrial progress, weren't they? I mean, this was what the factory system relied on.
Well, this, you see, made England what it is.
Right.
Because there were millions of these in Lancashire and Yorkshire and places like that.
And it was women's work?
No. The first weavers were men. But so, when it moved into the factories, of course, then women's labour was cheaper.
Right.
So then they started using more women's labour because men got paid more.
Yeah, because when you look in the factory books
produced
in the middle of the 19th century, they say two very important but apparently contradictory things about what's happening when these power looms are being introduced. On the one hand, they're saying, look, these are extraordinary machines. They can do all the labour of skilled human beings. So all we need to run them are what they describe as very unskilled people. On the other hand, they also say, and the very good thing about the power loom system is that it will mean that human labour will become more relaxed, that people will only have to tend machines rather than to watch them all the time. So you've worked on machines like this. What's your experience of tending a number of machines?
Well, I've got to dispute that, you see, because it was
good
skilled labour.
For sure.
I mean, to weave on these looms, when you get a set of 10 of these, to keep them going all day.
So it was one man like yourself looking after 10?
10, or women.
Yeah.
It slowly but surely come more women than men on weaving side.
Yeah.
But there was skill in it. You can't just put any Tom, Dick and Harry on these looms or they're going to get something trapped.
Right.
So,
what's the rate at which they're working? I mean, so you're almost running.
Yeah, oh yeah, because every time your loom stops, your wages stop.
Right.
So the more you can keep them going and the yardage you got paid by the yard, of course your wage is going to be greater.
So you're not being paid by clock watching, but
you're
how
paid
much,
by what you produce.
How much cloth comes
if
out,
a loom is stopped, your wage is stopped. So you kept going. And the more you did, you see. See, the funny thing about weaving, the harder you work, the less wage you get, because that means your looms are giving you trouble.
Right.
The less work you do, if you can just walk around, sauntering around, your money's being made. It's a silly job in that respect, yeah?
Right. All the components are really extraordinary examples of engineering, and for looms, power looms are superb examples of engineering. Each bit of the loom, the shuttle and so on, would be made at a different works.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, yeah. Every little bit on this loom, as you can see, Accrington, Blackburn.
Yeah.
The weft forks be made somewhere else.
Lupton Brother.
Bits and mats, the picking noses, all made at different factories.
Yeah.
So, the people in the mill, say our mill employed 400 people,
but
also outside workers making bits and mats for loom. You talk about hundreds of more people making things as well, so it kept a lot of people employed.
Right. And lots of the components really do look as though they're imitating what humans are doing. For example, the picking stick looks like the arm and hand of someone who's actually picking the thread.
Exactly the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who controlled the rate at which the loom was running? I mean, for example, these are powered from overhead belts. Who's in charge of the engine rate and the rate at which the belt is running?
Well, you see, like this mill, we run on water.
Right.
So, of course, if you had a decrease in water flow,
your
looms would run slightly slower.
So that was a seasonal
thing? That was a seasonal thing, and then that meant the workers had to work longer.
And what sort of hours in the day would you be working?
You used to do 12 hours regular here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I did about 8 hours a day when I started in the 1950s.
Right.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's interesting is that the design of the machine itself isn't changing very much
no.
over a comparatively long period.
No.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it was such a brilliant invention in
you
the first place. Absolutely brilliant.
It was perfect on delivery.
Victorians, if you go back in history, the Victorians were brilliant. When they built a machine, it was built to last and it did the job. Like these now, all over 100 year old, doing exact, and they can weave cloth as good as any modern loom. The only fault is they're too slow.
Yeah.
That's the only difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how would you accelerate the rate? I mean, there's this kind of upper limit for
well,
sure,
I mean,
isn't there?
What weavers used to do, that loose pulley there, they would put a stuff called grippo on the loose pulley.
Yeah.
And that'd make your loom go faster. Because the faster it went, the more wage you got. So they'd always have a piece of grippo on them.
Right.
But the trouble with that is I'm the tackler now, and when I come to do a broken belt,
yeah.
and you throw that belt on that pulley up there, and you're supposed to let it slip round a bit before you put it on your loose pulley, it's grabbing, so it's trying to grab you. So the tacklers didn't like them putting grip or one, but
sure.
they did, so.
Right, so yeah. there was a bit of a conflict
bit
there.
Of conflict there, yeah. you see, yeah.
How about getting trained? Because as you say, I mean, it's completely obvious that working 6, 8, 10 looms is really a highly skilled job. How long would it take for a worker to get up to the kind of rate that you would get as an experienced man?
I would say 18 months to learn you the basics
right.
of weaving, but when you first go on a set, it's absolute chaos.
You so what did you do? You stand, you, you,
no,
you stand you, next to an expert?
Yeah, you hand. Go with an experienced stand, but even when you leave her and go on your first set, when you watch these old dears, as I, the old spinsters,
yeah.
they could just saunter out and the set would run. You as a young bloke thought, and you were running helter-skelter around and you couldn't get them running.
Right.
Until you got into a system. And once you got into your own system, you could do exactly the same as them. But for months and months, you couldn't do it as good as them.
But I
no.
guess everyone's system was a bit different from everybody
else's.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Some people walk around different way. Or some people only look at front, don't look at back. So,
yeah.
yeah.
yeah. And how... I mean, obviously your wages would go up as you gradually got more...
As you got better.
Yeah.
More efficient.
What
yeah.
about actually owning your tools? I mean, who owned that?
The, oh, the factory. You didn't own any tools. Oh, you own with your scissors.
Which is what you used to cut off
yeah,
the
that's right.
thread.
The redux, the steel combs, our mill provided them, but
right.
we used to buy our own scissors.
So you brought nothing to work except a pair of scissors and your lunch?
You brought yourself and your scissors.
One of the things that I think is important then is the way in which you have this very successful technology which, as you say, has basically solved almost all the production problems of actually getting cloth out of thread in vast quantities. This is a technology that lasts for a very long time. And then it goes into decline. I mean, when does that start, do you think? When
well,
does,
that,
what
well,
do
that
the big
started,
problems
oh,
of the industry begin?
In the 1930s, 1940s.
So it was already there when you were starting work?
Even
right.
when I was starting, all mills were starting shutting down then,
yeah.
even in Bolton. We had 143 mills in Bolton, at that, well, in the 1930s.
Yeah.
And of course, the decline was on. And the only reason it became, you see, England cannot produce its own cotton.
Right.
So what happens when the other countries start growing cotton and actually bought looms off England,
yeah.
like China, India, Brazil, they then put the price of raw cotton up to us.
Right.
So we can't compete with them then.
So you're seeing one of the main problems is not so much the limit of the work rate, but the export of machinery.
The raw cotton. Because
yeah.
when I first started in the mill, we used to get our cotton from Egypt.
Sure.
And then we went on to Hong Kong. And then we were going to other countries where the quality wasn't as good because
yeah.
the price, you see,
yeah.
was going up and up.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
But if, as you say, and of course it's absolutely clear, England never managed to grow any cotton, why was it that this part of Lancashire, where we are standing now, is the first and principal place where you get this kind of automation of the whole cotton industry? What are the big factors here, in your view, that are
climate,
making that possible?
Climate, you see, Lancashire, Yorkshire, well known for quite a heavy rain.
Yeah.
All Lancashire towns are nearly always in a valley where you get dampness.
Yeah.
Liverpool, because you had the docks coming from America, American cotton, India, you know. So it was in a very ideal position. And every Lancashire town had a good flow of water, because if you notice, all mills were built on a river.
Sure.
Yeah.
And looms like this, of course, had to stand on the ground floor because they needed that kind of concrete support.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you have the railway system connecting Liverpool with the Manchester system.
Blackburn and Burnley.
I mean, what's striking is how important even the most subtle local variation is. For example, I suppose if you tried to start mills like this even 5 miles away, if the climate wasn't right, then they'd fail.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Because in summertime in mills, when we know humidity, the first thing you did when you walked in the mill, you used to slosh the floor with buckets of water to get some dampness, else they won't leave.
Right, so we have to imagine a room like this full of, say, 1,000 looms in constant damp, constant moisture.
Yeah. You needed that dampness
in
the atmosphere.
Because otherwise the thread
won't
breaks.
Won't just breaking all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And beyond that, you have, I mean, this is an important question for us, isn't it? You have an availability of skilled labour, I mean, of people who can actually be trained to do the sort of work that you were doing. Right.
Because it went through families, you see. You get the grandma, the granddad, the mothers.
Was that true for your family?
Yeah, all my family, Albany Mills all the life.
Right, right.
Yeah, right through the family.
So there is, I mean, so there are very long traditions of working in skilled work like this. I mean, as I say, you know, what I find so striking is that the apostles of the factory system in the 30s and 40s are always arguing in print that this will make the kind of skill that you're talking about completely unnecessary. You won't have to have family groups. You won't have to have training. Everyone who works in a mill, they claim, will be able to work almost the moment they walk in the door, and your career shows
how
wrong that is.
They're living in cloud cuckoo land, I'm afraid, as you find most managements do, you know, on these clever clogs, as we call them.
Sure. So we have to imagine a room like this with about 1,000 power looms working full out, and you have to maintain the atmosphere really moist in case the threads break. It sounds like a pretty unpleasant environment.
It's like, no, it's like anything else, isn't it? I mean, with the noise, that was the worst factor, because the first fortnight you started in the mill as a young lad.
You had to wear earplugs?
No, there were no such thing. You never heard of earplugs. For the first fortnight, when you went out to the mill at night, people sounded as though they were talking from a long, long way away, as though they were whispering.
Yeah.
And then after a fortnight, it was as though your ears were beginning to adjust, then you were all right. But what you don't realise is slowly but surely you're going deaf.
You're going deaf.
Yeah, and I now wear a hearing aid.
Yeah.
Because when I'm watching telly, I can't hear it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it shouldn't be too nostalgic about people having to work in an environment like this.
No, the best part is, you see, you were like a big family. Say a tower mill where there were 300, 400 people. You knew everybody, everybody knew you. You had a laugh and a joke. See, when you're doing like quite a boring job, monotonous, repetitive job, there's laughter. And there's always a good laugh at mill. You know, you could have a laugh and a joke.
Yeah.
So that made your day pass over, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. When you had time to talk, that is. You know, you didn't always have time to talk. If you're having a bad run, load of Enzo, you couldn't talk then, but
and there was a lot of and there was a lot of teasing by the more experienced hands,
I suppose. I'll say. Yeah. When you first searched at mill, the old blokes would come down and say, watch out for the old spinsters when you lent over at loom or else they'll have you.
In what way?
Oh, in what way? A disgusting way.
Okay. And there were injuries?
Yeah. The biggest injuries in phones, John. The injuries in mills are nearly always caused by the shuttle flying out. We've all been hit with them. It's part of your job.
Yeah.
There's nothing you can do about it. All you need sometimes is one end to break out. And it's what we call lashing in at the front. And, of course, it just throws your shuttle out.
I mean, that's this thing.
Yeah, it just comes out, flies out in your side. The worst I ever got were right in the corner of my eye. And it knocked me out for a few seconds. So that's the worst thing.
Right. So, wearing protective clothing.
No, still don't, you see. There's nothing you can protect
against. Because there isn't anything you can
do. No, right. It might be 10 years before one flies out, you never know.
You also had to guard against sparks, of course, because it's a pretty combustible, I mean, it can be pretty combustible.
Well, that's why everything, if you look at these machines, you see it's nearly all cast iron.
Yeah.
Because cast iron doesn't spark, same as steel.
Yeah.
So, it's not very, we've only had one fire in here, a little fire on that loom there, and that was a bottom shaft burning up, and it just sparked, and that set a fire off. But other than that, they run for years without sparking, Now, when electric motors come in, that were a different kettle of fish.
So what happened?
You had a lot
then?
Of fires.
Yes.
Because, of course, when you set an electric motor and you get one little spark,
and that's
up
it
goes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because where were the motors put? I mean, these things were on the ground
every loom,
floor.
Every loom.
And you...
At the side of your loom there. And just one little spark, of course, up it went.
Right.
Yeah.
So then they would get rid of the overhead belts and...
Yeah, no belts. But where your girders. And where it used to happen, you get all fluff on top of the girders. So when it used to run up the pole with the fluff, it was like gunpowder going along the top.
Yeah, because
and it just dropping all different, with 22 looms on fire one now.
No, because it's like having a cotton fuse running right through
that's
the works.
That's it.
Isn't
Absolutely. Just like gunpowder. For 25 years, and the only time they painted our shed was where Montgomery, Lloyd Montgomery, were walking about 10 looms up, 10 looms across, where he were walking, they painted, the rest they never bothered with.
Right.
No.
And because it was damp all the time, presumably there was a lot of water in the air. But you wouldn't have noticed that because it was there all the time.
You don't notice
time.
It. You just get used to it.
No, it's it is amazing what folk can put up with.
And none of us suffer, everybody I know that works here, nobody suffers with like bad bones or anything like
sure,
that.
I don't know. If we think about the relationship between human beings working on these machines and the machines themselves, did you see the machine as a friend, an enemy, something you had to coax and cope with? Did you feel exploited by it or?
Not the machines, no.
But you had trouble with other workers?
Well, when you're a weaver, you have a bloke called a tackler, which I now am.
Right.
And when I were a young lad, the tacklers were swines. The majority of them were absolute swines.
Explain what tacklers do.
Well, tacklers do all the repairs on your machines.
Right.
And when you used to go for them, it was though no matter what broke on that machine, it was though you broke it.
Right. So tacklers always told you that it was your fault.
That's right. And the tackler could make or break your wage, because if you went for a job, they could make you wait, and your loom would stop, your wage would stop.
Yeah.
So they were like bosses kind of thing, you know.
And the tacklers got their wages from
the
owner.
They got the wages come what may, didn't make no difference.
So whereas you were getting paid only when the machine was working, they were always getting paid.
If all your machines were stopped, it didn't bother them one iota.
Right, right.
And they were like, some of them, I mean, you had your decent blokes, but I would say two-thirds of them, you could have killed them. You could, because they were absolute, they made your life a misery, especially the young girls. They used to have them crying. Shit at them every day. Without,
And you're a tackler now.
I'm a tackler now, but
Are you one of those people?
No, I always said, because I'd been a weaver for quite a few years, I always said if I ever got tackling, I would never be like them old boys, because I've seen the... You know, upsetting people. There's no need. They get a good wage. But what they want to do is come in, sit on a bench, fasten the jacket in a vice and stand up maybe and fall a bloody sleep, and that were it.
Right.
Yeah. And if somebody come for a job, a weaver come for a job, that were like, they shouldn't be coming to me, I want to fall asleep, you know. I've seen it all, don't worry.
At the beginning of the weaving system in the 18th century, of course, with handloom weavers work at home, they work with their family. What we see happening in the late 18th, early 19th century, of course, during the process of automation and mechanization, is that handloom weavers are driven out of employment, and you get weavers brought into the factories, brought into sheds like this. I mean, should we regret the loss of that kind of more domestic more family-oriented work. I mean, there was enormous deprivation, of course, enormous immiseration around the destruction of handloom weavers' jobs. How do you think we should remember that change from handloom weaving and the putting out system to this more factory system?
Well, I should imagine most of them are glad, because I've done handloom weaving at the Silk Heritage, and that is far harder work than machines doing it for you.
Mind you, you don't like working with silk very much.
No,
do
I don't like working with
you're
silk
more
because
a
I,
cotton man.
I always say it's like a clinging woman. You can't throw silk and polyester away.
Right, right.
But the trouble with handloom weaving is when you've done 8 hours on a handloom and you're banging it in and you're doing 300 picks to the inch,
yeah,
and you're doing a circle for a tie, at the end of 8 hours it's not a circle anymore, it's an oval, because you're getting tired.
And you've lost the
You won't get paid.
Yeah.
So you've got to bang that in, and after 8 hours, believe me, it was very, very hard work.
So handloom weavers have to be vigilant even more than machine miners.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah. That is what I call grafting, real grafting.
Yeah.
This in comparison on machines, you see the machines doing most of the work for you.
Right.
I know you mind a lot more.
Sure.
And you're still working very hard, but give me machinery than handloom weaving anytime, yeah. Mm.
So this is a power loom of the 1890s, the Nelson model. Wouldn't have changed very much, I guess, in about 50 years. It was exactly this kind of machine which drove the cotton revolution of the 19th century. What we see in machines like this is the way in which automation reaches a kind of end already by the middle of the 19th century. Human capacities are systematically remodeled and replaced by machinery. For example, if you get this picking stick moving backwards and forwards with its elegant leather strap at the end of the flying shuttle, the picking stick is doing exactly what a very skilled normally female worker would have been doing in picking the cotton as the shuttle moved backwards and forwards in front of the power loom. So on the one hand, machines like this are essentially ways of replacing skilled labour by reliable automated machinery. But we mustn't make the mistake of supposing that automation and mechanization are just all about the ever-expanding role of the machine. In order to keep devices like this going, you also need very skilled human beings. Those human beings tending the machines, running between groups of machines, simply to keep the production process up and running, and only being paid when the machines are working. So the process of mechanization and automation is on the one hand a process of the displacement of human skill, but on the other hand that displacement includes new kinds of skill and new kinds of expertise. And during industrialization it's that reorganization of what skilled human beings do that I think holds the key to economic and social change. So this is a